Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're talking about 18th century English towns and trying to use them to capture not just more general points about the development of towns, and after all, many of the towns we live in today, certainly Exeter, where I live, include a number of 18th century buildings and a lot of the 18th century town plan in the centre. But we're also trying to use it in order to capture elements of the social history of the period. And in doing so, what we're trying or seeking in The Critic to do is not just to offer, as it were, an account of history, important as that is, and not least at a period in which much of the history of our country is being at the best slighted and often ignored or even trashed, but also to offer opportunity to reflect on the present situation and on present possibilities. And one of the reasons in The Critic we think this is particularly important is there is obviously the approach to the past of things today are always getting better, the past is clearly redundant, i.e. pushed off into a history lesson or ignored or held up simply as a foil for the better and perfect future. Or, as in The Critic, we would argue that actually the present and the future are by no means ipso facto better than the past, and therefore the past offers us an opportunity to reflect on the present and think about the future. And it is in that spirit that I am presenting this series of talks about towns, and I'm deliberately moving quite slowly because I don't want to rush through as in a kind of, shall we say, some other podcasts who present you with a frivolous account of which can be amusing or interesting, but which is actually intellectually quite barren. What I'm trying to do is to actually use the past to tease out either explicitly or, you know, this is an intelligent audience for you to do the work, implicitly comments that are of relevance to the present. So let's start off with the degree to which urban life clearly offered freedom. It had problems, and we're going to be talking about that, but it clearly offered freedom. Now, towns obviously didn't provide equality of opportunity, but nevertheless, in a sort of Dick Whittington fashion, they had the lure of opportunity. And the sustained migration to them was a testimony to this. Each migrant, and of course Whittington, a younger son, was born in Gloucestershire in 1354, becoming an apprentice in London. Each migrant represented an individual decision that life might be better in a town. Now, for many, this proved illusory, rural penury translating into urban poverty. And you can think about similar experiences at the present moment, that people who move out, shall we say, of the poorer parts of England, shall we say, Workington or Blythe or Redruth, and go to London or Birmingham, find often that life is very, very tough, and actually that, you know, they'll get jobs generally, but nevertheless that there can be enormous difficulties. But you know, towns then, as today, contained impoverished, squalid and dangerous areas. So obviously did the countryside. Though one of the interesting aspects of modern social policy is that county councils often decant their social problems into the towns. Indeed, urban degradation was in some way more pernicious than its rural counterpart because of the absence of the social and community support that was more prevalent, not by no means universal, in rural parishes, although that, of course, was not without its own harshness and exclusions. Indeed, it's necessary to remember that alongside the consumerism and the middling orders I've been talking about and will go on to make more comments about, The town had many other economic and roles and social milieus, which were, shall we say, not of ease and elegance. There's the important role of manufacturing in towns, and the extent to which economic shifts and problems, which were many and varied, could push artisans, ordinary workers, into what we would today be called the underclass. However, the social system was also more fluid in towns. Mobility was greater, upward mobility as well as downward. Traditional hierarchies were weaker and control was laxer. Urban populations were not on the whole radical in their politics or beliefs, but town life did provide the context for most new ideas, both elite and popular, and offered new experiences. As an interesting reflection of that, I can recall in Newcastle in the 1990s being told by a psychiatrist, who had hospital psychiatrist, who'd been talking to somebody brought in by the police who had tried to throw themselves off the Tyne Bridge, in other words, commit suicide. And this young man had said that he was very unhappy because he was a homosexual. And the psychiatrist had said to him, well, why don't you move to London? That you'll find it, you won't feel so isolated or unusual there. Now, I'm not sure that it would represent modern psychiatric practice, nor, I have no idea, would that represent an account of Newcastle life. But what's interesting was that that view would have seemed entirely customary, established in the 18th or 19th or the 20th century, the idea being that if you were unusual to an extent with local norms, you should move to a bigger city, or indeed the biggest city. It's true that urban populations were not on the whole radical in their politics or beliefs. That's a mistake, and I'm going to be dealing with that. But town life certainly did provide the context for most new ideas, both elite ideas and popular ideas, and offered new experiences. It was also easier to bridge the divide between elite and non-elite in towns, whether in the dissemination of fashions such as tea drinking and the wearing of imported cloth, or of new political views. The concentration of people in towns, their higher rates of literacy, and their more marked traditions of political autonomy and independence of attitude helped to foster, at least in part, a consumer society that went well beyond goods and services to include attitudes and beliefs. And another way of looking at that is to say that there was an element of democratization. Whether or not you had democracy, you had democratization. And in the last, of course, the 18th century prefigured the situation today, without the situation today necessarily being either better or worse, however we are to measure both those value judgments. Towns, of course, were also the forcing houses of the commercial economy and the culture of print, and through which Britain became not just a world power, commercial economy, the leading maritime power in the world, but also a political society that saw an international role, indeed an imperial dominance increasingly, as its national destiny. Now, it's true that you can present this relationship between, as it were, opinions in towns, what you might call urban politics, and what you might call town development in very different ways. And one must be wary of suggesting, and I've already noted that today in discussing the society of towns, that there's simply one experience and one development. Indeed, you need to note the vitality of differences and divisions within the urban community, including within the elite. Now, I would argue for the 18th century, for today, and you'll see in time for the 19th century, that it's unhelpful to isolate either stability or strife, either continuity or change, and also to treat them as in some way incompatible. Lazy people do that, i.e. 99.9% of the discussion of the past and the present. Instead, as was only to be expected, in what was a complex society with a high degree of political awareness and participation, there was both what we might call change and what we might call continuity. There was both what we might call division and what we might call unity. And their dynamic interaction, that I think is more important than the idea of them being dichotomous or opposed, their dynamic interaction provided much of the flavour of urban consciousness and politics. In other words, the rhetoric and politics of division, important as they were and indeed are, and I find it rather amusing that the Times is now informing us that culture wars is over, which I think is a rather funny idea. The rhetoric and politics of division didn't preempt the practice of cooperation or at least rubbing along. Now, I've already mentioned that the most prominent model of urban life was London, but other major towns also developed in part through their institutions and buildings. Take Norwich, which at the beginning of the 18th century was the second largest town in England, being passed very swiftly by Bristol, but just simply becoming the third largest. Bristol gained a lunatic asylum in 1714, a new shire hall in 1749, assembly rooms in 1754, a theatre in 1756, a hospital in 1771-2. A public subscription library in 1784 and a new county jail in 1792-3. Now, that's more infrastructure than actually a lot of British county towns have managed in recent decades. Smaller towns also expanded. Stockton, an important port for North Sea trade, acquired a new parish church in 1712, a customs house in 1730, a town hall in 1735, a theatre in 1788, and a grammar school in 1786. Now, Norwich was a long-established town, but there was also the rapid growth of newer centres, notably Liverpool and Birmingham. Of course, local circumstances, the money and energy of individuals and of the community were crucial. So not all towns moved at the same pace towards what has been described by many as an urban renaissance. For example, Taunton, county town of Somerset, there was hardly any new building of importance until the Market House was constructed in 1771. Urban economies were helped by the growing commercialization of life. The infrastructure of and for money transformed the nature of the domestic market and of townscapes. New covered markets and shops were opened, as were banks and insurance offices. But, as I've already argued, circumstances varied in both content and context, and with both intrinsic and extrinsic factors playing a role. These ranged greatly from fire in the first case, to so that's an intrinsic factor within the town itself, to communications in the latter, an extrinsic factor. Fire remained a major issue. So Blandford Forum in 1731, after which the town was rebuilt with the help of donation by George II and an Act of Parliament, producing a brick and tile town centre, including a larger marketplace that has lasted to the present. And if you go round Blandford Forum, you can very much see in the centre an 18th century town. In my county, Devon alone, Tiverton was hit hard by fire in 1726, 1730, and especially 1731, the last leading to an Act of Parliament that all roofs thereafter should be of lead, slate or tile. Whilst Crediton lost 460 houses to a savage fire in 1743, that was most of the town, and much of Honiton was rebuilt after fires in 1747 and 1765. Looking at extrinsic factors, communications, to take, for example, Cheshire. The comparatively slow growth of many Cheshire towns was due to a degree to their relatively poor links with the more dynamic centres in Lancashire. And therefore, when the towns in Cheshire, as they developed, those that had the better links developed more rapidly, because they obviously were able to serve both Liverpool and more particularly Manchester. Communications and the related attitudes were important, not least in reciprocating, you know, economic relationships through which dynamic towns created and sustained a regional network. Now, it's rather interesting. We often talk in about the 18th century in terms of a sort of Enlightenment confidence. A very recent book by Jonathan Clarke has drawn attention to the problems with Enlightenment as a concept, which is a valuable book. But leaving aside its value as a concept, there's also the question of how it is as a reality. So let me, for example, pick something from the genre of what was called in the time strange news. In other words, matters that didn't appear to fill the rational world. So on the 30th of May 1723, so we're talking about the age of Sir Isaac Newton, if you like, the Weekly Courant of Nottingham, Nottingham's leading paper, its only paper then actually, carried a London report of 5 days earlier. Quote, "For several nights last week, a bird was heard to sing in the dissenters' burying ground in Burnhill Fields." That, for those of you who know these things, will know that's where Daniel Defoe was buried. And you'll also know that those burial fields or graveyard is still there, just near Moorgate. "It began at 11 and continued its song for most of the night. This drew a great concourse of people that way, and some of the old women would needs have it the spirit of a female child that was found there a few days before, supposed to have been murdered. On Thursday it ceased its note, and the old women in the neighbourhood being assembled, according to custom, were puzzled to assign a cause for the loss of their feathered songster, one of more age and gravity than the rest, declaring she thought he had absented on account of Mr. Layer being to be hanged next day." Christopher Layer was a Jacobite, prominently involved in the retribution after the Atterbury plot, sort of show trial, and he was hung. I think it's fair to say that the paper, the report, is making fun of these comments, but at the same time as making fun of them, it is, as it were, ironically noting their prevalence. And of course, you always see that kind of dynamic in these days. Of course, people would use terms such as the elite versus the populace. You can take different views on that at the moment, but certainly you can capture that element in the 18th century. Aside from the problems such as fire, disease remained a serious issue in towns, the year divided by the prevalence of particular illnesses. The limited nature of the night housing stock led to a sharing of beds that encouraged a high instance of respiratory infections and explained the way in which variations in disease within towns were related in many senses to wealth. Obviously, the wealthier you are, you lived with a bit more space and you didn't necessarily have to share a bed with strangers or with siblings and so on. Meanwhile, the Revolution settlement, going to politics here, the Revolution settlement that followed the Glorious Revolution of 1688 to 89 made a parliament with regular elections a permanent feature of the political system, and that greatly enhanced the political influence of towns, because as I've already mentioned, the majority of parliamentary seats were urban. This was seen, for example, in 1704, when Robert Harley, a Tory Secretary of State, subsequently Earl of Oxford, wrote to George Stepney, the envoy in Vienna, concerning a petition from Exeter and several other West Country parliamentary constituencies complaining about Austrian tariffs on British woolen cloth. Now, the crucial background here is Britain and Austria were jointly fighting against France. 1704 is the year of the Battle of Blenheim. British troops had marched as far as the Danube to help protect Austria from Franco-Bavarian invasion. Here, quote, "There is the greater reason to consider the petitions and endeavour to obtain redress herein, because beside the general interest of the nation, The members from the West have a great influence in the resolution of the House of Commons, and especially in the granting of money. Now, that would have been a convenient point to say to Stepney in order to get him, as it were, to make that point to the Austrians. And always with instructions, diplomatic instructions, you have to be aware that much has been written from the point of view of conveying a message to the other country. But nevertheless, that does not mean it's inherently untrue. Parliament, of course, also provided a setting for rivalry between towns. So, for example, legislation of 1721, introduced by Waller Bacon, who was one of the two MPs for Norwich, after petitions from woolen manufacturers, the many woolen manufacturers, cloth, woolen cloth manufacturers in East Anglia, that legislation prohibited the import of plain white calico by the East India Company and thereby hit the domestic calico printers who competed with these manufacturers. In a sense, it was a Norwich measure, or an East Anglian measure, I should say, also would have had support in the West Country, the great cloth industry at that time, against essentially London interests. The understanding of towns, in part, is a matter and was a matter of the debate over the nature of society, how far there was a coherent urban interest and how far not, which was a major issue at the time, and how far, this is more a more subsequent scholarly concern, how far it was a commercial society dominated by what's been called a middling order, or whether the emphasis should be on elite influence, both within towns and on towns from neighbouring landlords. Towns were certainly important in the definition of political attitudes. However, the extent of their influence over rural areas is difficult to evaluate, especially as most of the sources are of urban origin. So, for example, The Craftsman, leading opposition newspaper, in its issue of the 7th of October 1727, declared of London, quote, "The eyes of the whole nation are constantly fixed on the conduct and proceedings of this city as the primum mobile of Great Britain." Well, yes. London was important, it was Parliament, etc., etc. But of course, The Craftsman would say that because it was published in London. Towns were certainly a social focus for the surrounding countryside, for example, with the assizes and the race meetings. But it's too easy to focus on urban perspectives and norms, as well as the interests of trade, as opposed to the landed interest, which bore a relatively heavy tax burden. And we can see analogous problems or issues today, when all too often the views of the metropolis or metropolitan circles are taken as in some way indicative of those of, let's say, the whole of urban England, or indeed the whole of the country. A clash of interests and cultures was certainly presented by novelists. For example, Tobias Smollett in his novel Lancelot Greaves, which came was published in parts between 1760 and 1761, looked back to the last general election of 1754, and it describes an election in a fictional town. The Tories arrived first in the market town, which is unnamed and therefore everywhere, with their emphasis on the landed interest met by a hostile multitude who throw stones, dirt, and dead cats, while the Whig candidate, backed by the town authorities and emphasising the tradition of William III and the House of Hanover, is a Jewish stockjobber down from London. So in other words, in that election, anti-Catholicism, the attack against the landed interest, who is held up to be Jacobite by their Whig opponents, is shown as vying with anti-Semitism in the sense of the opposition to London interests. And indeed, these themes can be found in the press reporting of events that occurred. So the Salisbury Journal of the 7th of January 1754 recorded the celebrations in the nearby town, clothmaking centre, in fact, of Devizes, following the swift repeal the previous year of the Jewish Naturalisation Act of 1753. The Whig government had passed an act making it easier for Jews to be naturalised. This was linked to the importance of Jewish financial interests in helping finance the British national debt, and in particular the links between the First Lord of the Treasury, Henry Pelham, and various banking groups. So, quote, this is from the Salisbury Journal. Last, and this gives you a flavour of town life that you possibly don't think about when you walk through squares and along crescents and so on. Last Friday, the gentleman and principal tradesman of this borough met at the Black Bear Inn, of course you would meet at an inn, to rejoice on account of the repeal of the Jew Bill. And though numbers of different persuasions were assembled on this occasion, yet party and prejudice were entirely laid aside, and all were unanimous in expressing their joy and highest approbation. The effigy of a Jew was carried through every street in town, attended with all sorts of rough music. Several men had torches that the inhabitants might see the effigy and read the paper that was stuck on his breast, containing these words: "No Jews. Reformation to the bishops." Let me explain that. What they're saying there is that the bishops, which were dominated by the government, because the government had appointed, the Whig government had appointed most of them, the bishops were Whigs, and they had supported the naturalisation, what had been the Naturalisation Act, and Christianity forever. They made a halt two or three times in every street, drank and repeated the above amidst the acclamations of a great number of people. A large fire was made, and they burnt the body of the Jew and set his head on the top of the pillory. The bells rang, and beer was given to the populace. Several loyal healths were drank by the gentlemen, etc., and likewise variety of toasts applicable to the occasion. The Thursday following, being market day, the head was again put on top of the pillory, which gave great delight to the farmers and other country people. Now, it's interesting. If you read an account like that, and correspondence makes it quite clear that these accounts were accurate, to consider, shall we say, aspects of subsequent, whatever you might wish to call it, in Britain, in attitudes. It's just interesting. And obviously you can make your own reflections, but what certainly is mistaken is to ignore this element when you're thinking about the 18th century. Or there's a letter I came across in the British Library Manuscript Division by a chap called William Lorimer, commenting on the failure of Sir William Culvert, a former Lord Mayor, prominent brewer, and which was always very important and a major source of wealth and of electoral support and government supporter. He failed to win re-election as an MP for London. This is 1754. Culvert came pretty near, and it is certain he had the majority of merchants and substantial people, but the mob could not forgive his joining in the Jewish Bill. These elements were part of a more general tension over religion within towns. Among the more striking elements are anti-Catholicism and anti-Semitism. There were also important rivalries within Protestantism, particularly between supporters of the Church of England and dissenters. So, for example, the diary of Edmund Harold, a Manchester wig maker, reveals that he was unsure whether he should marry a dissenter. Dissenters tended to congregate in town. A sense of place was certainly seen in electioneering. So, for example, in 1767, Viscount Hampden noted grumbles in Lewes that a candidate came as far from home as Hertfordshire to Sussex, in other words. The following year, in the bitterly contested election in Preston, local links were an issue. A fly sheet I found in the Lancashire County Record Office in Preston, a fly sheet in favour of the corporation candidate opposing, quote, an alien, by which it meant somebody who didn't live in Lancashire, as well as this borough ever being annexed to any family, which was a reference to the influence of the Earls of Derby, the great magnates of Lancashire, in fact. There were also unsuccessful attempts in 1766, 1777 to end the dominance over Morpeth of the Earls of Carlisle, another local family. Smollett was also spot on with reference to his presentation of electoral corruption, a theme also seen with the works of Henry Fielding. Thus, the electors of the constituency of Weymouth and Malcolm Regis, about 300 freeholders to elect four members of Parliament, despite an agreement of 1744 among the different electoral interests ensuring uncontested elections for over half a century, still expected the customary election time treats. In the 1761 election, A document in the Tucker papers in the Bodleian reveals that £295.12, which was a princely sum, had to be spent on 10 public house bills. And the following year, the unopposed re-election of one of the candidates cost £201.19.6. The blunt side of electioneering was shown in the Yorkshire election of 1742. William Buck reporting, this comes from the Rockingham papers, reporting, one Flint, a famous York bully, had during the poll been committed for assaulting Mr. William Turner. I mean, Mr. William Turner was, as you may know, the successful Whig candidate. He was bailed. When Mr. Turner was chaired, that's in other words, having been elected, the member was put in a chair and publicly carried round by his supporters. This rascal, this Flint, appeared at the head of the mob and attempted to assault Mr. Turner. But Tom Paulin, a man of weight, knocked him down twice. So electioneering in York in 1742. A discussion of urban politics, and you know, people got killed in 18th century electioneering. Discussion of urban politics frequently related to the social background of opponents. Much of the criticism was directed, again, in the early half of the century, against the opposition to the Walpole ministry, with pro-government papers, such as the Daily Courant, a London paper, particularly critical. So, for example, on the 30th of April, 1734, it referred to what it called mechanical statesmen, all undone by following politics instead of the trade they were bred to. In other words, this is a Whig paper arguing that ordinary people should bloody well not get involved in politics and get on with their work. And in 1734, this is pertinent to general election year. And on 19th of October added, wonderful indeed is the power of patriotism. It's being sarcastic or reference to the opposition use of patriotic ideas. It opens and enlarges all the faculties of the mind. Inspired by this illustrious passion, the attorney's clerk will talk like an oracle on the nature and origin of government, on the power of kings and the liberties of the people, and fancy himself capable of holding the Great Seal, in other words, being Lord Chancellor, before he knows how to fill up a bond. So in other words, the urban and political environment is seen as threatening to the elite dominance. The elite is being dominated at this point by the, in inverted commas, progressives, the Whigs, because, of course, ordinary people are expressing a point of view and moving across and against what is seen as their social position or their generational position. Regular attempts, indeed, to prevent the sale of unstamped newspapers, which were significant in London, served as a way to restrict the circulation of the news. At the same time, ministerial commentators, of course, defended their own supporters. Notably, for example, in response to the opposition criticism of the city address to the new king, George II, in 1727. So the Flying Post, which to its opponents was called the Flying Post, one of the major Whig newspapers, in its issue of the 13th of July, 1727, reported, though many false and malicious as well as foolish insinuations have been made in order to bring into contempt the late method for joining in an address to His Majesty by the citizens of London, as if the address had been chiefly signed by porters, cartmen and illiterate people, we are well assured that the whole is so much forgery. In other words, opposition people were saying, aha, the government itself is drawing on people that shouldn't be part of the political process. 2 days later, the London Journal, another pro-government newspaper, and when I say pro-government newspaper, they got money from the government. So it's equivalent like, I don't know, the BBC, for example. 2 days later, the London Journal provided a detailed account of how the address was drawn up, making it clear that Gibraltar and the national debt had both been hotly contested in the discussion and that a dispute over the rights of aldermen had played a part. Key themes in foreign policy were also at dispute, therefore, in the public domain. That was not the only tempo in the published debate about urban identity and consciousness. Another version was the publication of Urban History, which was often heavily politicised, and was also a new version of the long-established Pride of Place, which was reflected in ritual, in sociability, institutions and politics, including feast and feast sermon. Bristol had its first complete history. the History and Antiquities of the City of Bristol by the antiquarian and surgeon William Barrett, published there in 1789, a work that included the famous hoaxes perpetrated by Thomas Chatterton, who claimed to have discovered a medieval source. In contrast, Andrew Hook, a pro-government Whig newspaper owner who had started to publish a history in 1748, couldn't make it pay. Now, both Hook and Barrett praised the role of trade and argued that it was a moral as well as a practical good, one reflecting virtue and industry. It was in accordance, indeed, with the conventions of urban history that Barrett argued that trade and navigation caused towns to prosper. He also claimed that urban history was more valuable than its county counterparts, as it demonstrated the value of economic activity. Hook advanced similar themes. Depth was provided by the reiteration of the long-standing tradition that Bristol had an ancient origin, which was actually not true. Very differently, as I've already mentioned, Chatterton also went on the same theme by forging medieval works. Hook, in contrast, which was very interesting, argued from the absence of evidence, suggesting that early chronicles were only concerned by the doings of the church and had therefore ignored the trade that was there. Now, town charters and histories very much linked the past to present legal rights and politicking. Thus, John Whittaker received the thanks of Manchester in 1793 for his book, The Charter of Manchester Translated with Explanation and Remarks, which had come out 6 years earlier, a work produced in vindication of the rights of the town against the Lord of the Manor. Now, that's a traditional course for historical work. You may recall when I was talking about the medieval period, I talked about how, for example, in St. Albans and Bury St. Edmunds, the townspeople were very, again, the rights claimed, privileges claimed by the abbeys there. But this was now pursued in print as part of the process of justification and lobbying, and also reaching out to a wider milieu, or potentially a wider milieu, I might say. Other aspects of urban identity were the foundation of newspapers, which I've already mentioned, and civic portraiture. This emphasis on distinctive urban identity was in interplay with the degree to which national links were strengthening, notably through improved communications, which became particularly apparent from mid-century as more turnpike roads were established. In other words, to a degree, the local was giving way, not so much to the regional, but rather to the national. There was also, I would argue, a process of political and religious easing, one facilitated by the weakness in much of England, as opposed to Scotland, of Jacobitism, the peaceful accession of George II in 1727, there was no fighting, the linkage of Tories and opposition Whigs, the peaceful replacement of Walpole in 1742, the defeat of the Jacobite rising of the 45, and an easing of religious tension from the early 1720s, following the failure of Whig attempts in the late 1710s to limit the Church of England in favour of the dissenters. In towns such as Great Yarmouth, on which there's a very good book, a workable accommodation with dissenters was gradually teased out. And by the 1720s, there was scant interest in any enforced uniformity. There was also a degree of compromise in the treatment of Catholics, although in the 1740s, the Whig Archdeacon of Cleveland broke up a Catholic convent in York. Defoe noted that Durham was, quote, full of Roman Catholics who lived peaceably and disturbed nobody and nobody them. For we being there on a holiday saw them going as publicly to mass as the dissenters did on other days to their meeting house. Now, this image of religious calm is a very satisfying one, which, however, describes more a tolerance at a given social level than the frequently more difficult relations with towns and within towns as well as societies, notably in periods of crisis. So Dudley Ryder, the Attorney General, recorded in his diary for the 3rd of December 1745, the day before the Jacobite army reached Derby, quote, "People in great pain for the city," by which he means the City of London. "Papists suspected of an intended rising as soon as the rebels are near London." This point serves as a reminder that circumstances were varied and could affect very much tones. Just as today, there could be good relations between different groups, whether religious, ethnic, social, or political, as well as poor relations. And the same is true across time. Partly as a result, there are difficulties with the evidence. This is particularly so in the vexed case of perception, a category at once important and difficult to assess, and particularly so when much of the population had only limited or no literacy, or if literate, left no sources. As a result, the 18th century is misleading, for the culture of print, which is what we tend to use, didn't encompass all. Even for those involved, there were conventions that can be misleading, as well as the weight, understandable but disproportionate, of the London example. What is certainly instructive is a cult of the town linked to an ideal of politeness as lifestyle and morality. Now, that was more aspiration than an accurate description, but nevertheless was an important model. What I'm going to do is go on next time to look at the second half of the 18th century. This finishes what I want to say about the first half, but I'm going to go on to the second half. And what I hope to do is to bring out some of the themes, but also, again, but we're also getting closer to the present day, closer to the 19th century, and we're going to see how those themes are teased through. Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jeremy. Really interesting. An interesting corrective too, I think, to how kind of popular history or history in the schoolroom is taught, which is to say people lived on the land and then, sometime after 1750, they started to move to big cities where factories and mills employed them with the latest industrialized methods. And you kind of were left to believe that before that, kind of people were just, if they weren't farmers, they were sitting in their cottage with a spinning wheel. But I think what you've shown in your talk now is that actually across the 18th century, there is a drift towards towns and an interest in towns as magnets of interest for people to move to. But in this period in the 18th century, before we get the large mills, the large factories, the kind of recognized aspects of mechanization that come later. What were the economic forces driving people from predominantly agricultural areas to the towns before the large factories and mills developed?
Oh, well, I think the key thing is the population growth, major population growth, particularly in the second half of the century, though beginning earlier than that. There's agricultural depression, I think it's fair to say, particularly in the Midlands in the 1720s and 1730s. I mean, rent levels are low for landowners. There are many farms they find it difficult to fill the tenancies of, and the price of agricultural goods are rather depressed in that period. It changes in the second half of the century in that respect. What do you do with younger sons? There are a whole host of issues about the degree to which rural society could only produce enough opportunities. And indeed, I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that the same is true today. Now, rural society is much, much smaller, but as a percentage of the population. But obviously, as you all know today, there are just not enough opportunities in agriculture to provide the jobs for many of those children. And, where I live, for example, you get drift from rural areas, both to London and to other urban centres such as Bristol or Exeter.
Yeah, very much so, very interesting. I just want to ask one last question. I was entertained by the point you made about people expecting their MP to be relatively local and talk about aliens because they're coming from a few counties away. Being posed to their MPs. I was wondering what really were the expectations of MPs representing towns in the 18th century? We've come, particularly in the last 100 years, particularly in the last 50 years, to almost expect an MP to be some kind of super local councillor who's often being lobbied by constituents to address local issues which are germane to the local community, more than being a legislator over in Westminster. What were the local expectations of MPs in terms of representing their towns in this period, as distinct from really sitting in Parliament and considering the national interest?
Well, a lot of the legislation in Parliament was in fact private acts of Parliament, particularly this gathers pace in the second half of the century, but it's already present before that in Turnpike Acts and in canal legislation prior to that first half of the century, River Improvement Acts, and then there's a whole host of things, harbour improvements or acts for the establishment of commissioners to improve the urban infrastructure. So there's local legislation, and remember the majority of MPs sit for towns, okay? So there's local legislation, which is very important. There's the advancing of local interests in other matters, so that you might personally go and see ministers and discuss things with them. That's very important. A lot of MPs do not speak. And that doesn't mean necessarily that they don't play a role, though. And I was reminded, I was discussing this, at drinks in my house last week, and one of my guests told me that his grandfather, who had been a Member of Parliament, had very rarely spoken in the House. So I think it's fair to say that there are many ways in which people could act. And the idea that today MPs have become sort of social workers reflects in a way the extent to which now, and I think this is unfortunate, instead of devoting their time to helping their community economically, helping the local businesses expand and so forth, instead of that, they tend to often, particularly, I'm afraid to say, with the Labour Party, but also with the Liberal Democrats, and there are some Conservatives, though fewer of those that this can be said of, they tend to often be negligent of the local economic interests, be more concerned with social policy issues.
Well, that's a contemporary note to end things on. We will continue this discussion of the town in the 18th century next week. But for now, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
A pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.